Welcome to the Azure Podcast, a series of short discussions on various topics related to the Microsoft Cloud Platform. Your hosts, Kale Teeta, Evan Basilek, Russell Young, and Sujeet DeMello discuss a specific topic on each show to give you a high-level overview of that topic and resources to get more information, should you wish to dig further. For more information on our show, please see our website at azpodcast.com.
All right, there we go. Well, welcome back to the Azure Podcast. This is episode number 218, being recorded on the 1st of March, 2018, with special guest Richard Cheney. And Sujeet, in a Skype with me, I have Evan, Kendall, Russell, and of course our special guest, Richard, who we'll get to in just a minute. But let's get started with some updates this week, and thanks for putting all those links in the show notes. Let's see, anybody have any favorites they want to go with first?
Mind me starting. I think the biggest thing to note is, you know, Kale's not on today, and there's no blockchain updates for a change. I thought that was quite.
That's because he's out planning in the next one, right? He told him to hold all the releases till he can be on the show.
Yeah. So I saw this one. So who posted this one about the size selection?
So I did. I went out there the other day. So I actually have some virtual machines that I use to run some of my own personal workloads. And I was mucking around with the sizes, trying, you know, because we've changed them a lot recently, trying to figure out what's the right, you know, right size of CPU and memory and all that to work for me. And I don't know about you guys, but as the IaaS sizes have really exploded in the last couple of years, and I guess this is true for PaaS VMs as well, it's become really difficult to cross-reference, like, what's my cost going to be, kind of what's my SKU, and just kind of managing that whole selection has been tough, right? And so I went out there the other day and saw this, and I love the new layout, right? You get a sense of your kind of relative prices very easily in a nice tabular fashion. You know, you can really easily compare across SKUs. I just thought it was great.
Yeah, I like it. Anything that saves you button clicks in the portal is good value for my point of view.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely.
So remind me, it used to be like this grid of icons, right, before?
Right. Yeah, and that worked fine when we had 12 different ones. That's it. But now we're up to, I don't know how many different SKUs.
Right, right. This is easy to see in one page, I suppose.
Yep.
Good. When you got the filters at the top, which is nice as well. So you can specify, you know, how many CPUs you want to put on there as a minimum and what type of disk you want and so on.
Right. Yeah. I think I could imagine, it just occurred to me, like, I could see us continuing to expand that to say, you know, maybe now we have some flags on subscriptions to say, hey, only show this subscription B series, and now if, you know, whoever owns that subscription, they go out and that's all they see is B series, right? They don't even run the risk of inadvertently picking something they shouldn't be, or, you know, whatever the case may be. So I can see real potential there.
Well, I've not tested it yet, but it'd be interesting to see if you apply policy to a subscription or a resource group, if when you start clicking your way through, that actually then automatically filters down that grid.
That's what I was thinking. It wouldn't surprise me in the least if that is there or is coming.
Yeah.
Right. Because it just makes sense.
Cool. Let's say, Kendall, you have any favorites in the new updates?
Yeah, I actually do. So the preview of log alerts for Application Insights, I think that's actually going to be really, really beneficial. I've worked with creating different alerts on network performance and OMS. And so I think having that feature, integrating that into a development environment, understanding, hey, you know, I have this specific defect and wanting to make sure that you don't get some exception in your log file, you can just go ahead and fire an alert. I think that could be really neat to see some of that automated and use some of that past data on performance of your application just to kind of check some new thresholds. So I think that'll be a really neat preview.
So is this basically allowing you to, in essence, put the equivalent to a webhook on any sort of query result then?
Yes.
Is that okay. Yeah, that is pretty cool.
Yeah, I think you can specify an interval, like it's every 10 minutes, you know, you run this and it'll look at all the updates from the last 10 minutes. And if there's anything that exceeds a threshold, you can fire off an alert.
Because I know even on my in the work that I'm doing now, a lot of the times, hey, the first place you want to go is the log file. So I think having it where, hey, the right people are getting this notification and can quickly kind of figure out what's going wrong, especially when you're doing deployments and things like that, I think this could be really helpful.
So, yeah, so one of the ones that, you know, last week we talked about the event grid. It went GA, and there's this update this week. And just kind of recap, you know, event grid is this nice feature that lets you essentially take away the to chore or polling for any update in any service. Normally, if you want to track something, you'd have to poll for it. EventGrid kind of does that tracking for you, and then can trigger something else on the other end. So right now, that they've added Service Bus as an optional trigger, so that if you see some change in an event, you can put a message on a Service Bus. So that's the update for this week in EventGrid. All right, let's see, what else we got over here that's good?
I like the files stuff personally. So, because that was always my dilemma, right? So Azure Files sitting on top of Azure Storage, redundant and all that kind of stuff. But always, my worry was always, well, what happens if somebody gets in there or I inadvertently delete something? Now I've deleted all multiple copies of my file. Now you can do Azure Backup. For Azure Files, right? So now you're backing up your files, which really just backs it up against, inadvertently mucking with a file or inadvertently deleting it. But you have the restore in it, and now that's on top of a really secure platform, or I'm sorry, a really redundant platform as well. So it's kind of the best of both worlds.
Yep, that's a good one indeed. The service endpoints for Azure SQL Database, right? So they're expanding that reach for service endpoints where they can lock down certain items to a specific VNet. And so Azure SQL has that, which is a huge thing. I think that's going to be huge. What else we got over here? Is that it? Azure Migrate. Do you guys see this one?
Richard, you've been there a lot on this, haven't you?
Yeah, I've taken a look at that today. Oh, we've got a bit of echo going there. And I think it's just an amazing looking product for a free service. The way that if you've got a VMware estate on premise and just import that OVA, set a point at your vCenter with some read-only credentials, you get a whole host of information with absolutely no disruption to anything. If you want to go deeper and get some information from the service map side of things, so you can see which applications are talking to which other virtual machines within your environments, i.e. which ones do you want to group together for a migration drop, then it pulls that out as well if you add on agents. So there's a huge amount of functionality there. It gets to that point where you know which virtual machines are going to be able to migrate, which ones can go over conditions, i.e. if the operating system is out of support, which ones are a good fit, and what size they should go to as well. And it gives you recommended migration types. So it's very quick to get to an assessment and start planning out that migration using ASR, Velostrata, or whatever else to then move that workload into Azure. So I think this is going to be big.
Yeah, we got to get somebody on to talk about that, because that's huge. I remember years ago I worked on a project where we were doing PFE has these health checks that they do. And was working with the PFEs and Premier to build a, migration assessment for Azure. And that was incredibly difficult. And all we were really doing was just kind of querying, a whole bunch of registry keys and properties. And that still took a tremendous amount of work. And now we've got a service that kind of does that and continues to get smarter and that kind of stuff. I think that's great, 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 great.
I think what's nice about it as well is this is just a version one.
Yeah.
So they've got it working with vCenter and it's just basically make us recommendations about which tools to use for the first party side for the migration. So database migration or ASR to shift stuff over. But they're obviously seeing it as a bit of a framework. There's a whole ecosystem out there with our partners. So, CloudMise, BitTitan, the two I mentioned earlier, plus a whole host of others who can help with that whole assessment and migration side of things. And they're very much seeing this as being the framework which then brings all that together. So I think as we move through time, we'll see this become really interesting.
Yeah, agreed.
What's interesting, Evan, about that program you mentioned with Premier and migrating single VMs, that program has now kind of evolved into a program for migrating data centers. So you're looking at whole clusters of machines, different workloads, and all that kind of stuff. So it's still there and alive and kicking, but it does a lot more now than it started off doing a few years back.
Wow, that's cool. Yeah, we got to get somebody on to talk about that as well, because that's a whole nother scale.
And just to be clear, this is primarily IaaS stuff, right? When they say workloads, I mean, I'm assuming, you can't.
I think generally, with Azure Migrator, I think it is. But when we're looking at data center migration and optimization, it starts off being that kind of a migration. But then you've got the opportunity to look at, what other PaaS services can we use without any work, without any extra effort. So, Azure SQL is an obvious one if you've got SQL workloads out there. And then maybe, are there opportunities to do some re-architecting, perhaps a bit of dev to take advantage of other PaaS services instead. So it's a staged thing, really.
Got it. And then there was this thing with the consistent backup for Linux VMs using Azure Backup. It's an update that's generally available now. And what it is, you know, if you have applications like, running on Linux, for example, MySQL and Oracle, I think having backups that are transactionally consistent is very important. And now that's supported. So that's an update on the Azure Backup. I think that's a wrap, right, for the updates? Did I miss anything? Oh, yeah. Somebody want to talk about this web app for containers thing? So
it's not a new feature. The feature's been there a little while now. So this is web apps running containers, Linux containers on web apps. The new thing that's been announced was that there's now a free option to try it out. So you don't even need a credit card to do it now. And you can get a free free trial of web app containers out there for, I think it's 30 minutes or something like that. But you can just go to the portal, try it out, give it a go, see how it works for you.
Oh, so you kind of bring your own container kind of thing and try it out there. So
yeah, that's it. And there are a whole load of predefined Docker images you can pick as well, but you can use your own ones.
Cool. All right, great. Well, that's a good roundup of all the updates. Let's get to our special guest, Richard. Richard, do you mind introducing yourself for our listeners?
No, absolutely. So my name is Richard. I've been working with Microsoft for coming up to a year and a half now. I actually work for Russell in the UK, so I'm one of the cloud solution architects that works with partners in the UK. And I've been working for about 12 years before that within the channel itself. So working for a number of service integrators on enterprise systems, mainly on-premise, but also a bit of private cloud within that as well. And before then, I was used to work for one of their customers as well. So I've kind of made that journey all the way through, which it makes me, I think, quite useful within the team because I've got an understanding of practice building within partner organizations and what they need to do to be able to achieve that. So I've got a big focus in what I do around the whole enablement side and how we get our partners to bridge the skills gap that we all know is out there still when it comes to cloud generally and Azure in particular.
So what excites you about Azure these days? What's your passion in Azure these days?
Pretty much everything, actually. I think one of the things that really excited me when I first started coming aboard was just how rich the whole ecosystem was and how broad the services are. And the more I've used the platform, the more I've fallen in love with it, if I'm absolutely honest. And being able to show that to partners and get them to the same level of excitement about what they can do and how quickly they can do that on the platform, what they can solve on behalf of their customers, I think is a big part of it for me. Coming from an IaaS background, coming from an enterprise background, then obviously I'm fairly comfortable with all the networking, storage, virtual machines, moving into containers, that side of things. And I've got a big focus on all the enterprise monitoring and management and the automation side, which is obviously why I'm here today. But I think is where you can take those workloads after that, all the various services that only make sense when you get to a large hyperscale cloud like Azure, and what that can mean for the applications of the future and how we modernize those workloads we're landing, I think is really where it gets exciting.
Yeah, so Sujit, I don't know if you remember, you kind of sent around, I think you got a list of things that the listeners wanted to hear about. Mm-hmm. And part of that list I sent around to the team, and Richard stepped up because he's been doing a lot of work on ARM templates, particularly around educating partners in that area. So I know he's built a lab on specifically how to do this, and I think he's going to talk a little bit about that and tell us what he's doing there. But one of the other things I wanted to kind of publicize here was the Azure Citadel initiative that we've got, which again Richard is behind. So I'll let him talk about it and describe it. But it's a nice rich way of getting education out, self-serving, that's available to everybody for free. Richard, do you want to expand on that a little bit?
Yeah, sure. So Azure Citadel is something that we've started putting together. It started off within the Cloud Solution Architecture team. Within the partner side of Microsoft, so OCP as we call it. And it's now kind of expanding out as more people are taking interest in it and seeing the quality of the labs that are on there and want to contribute some of their own to it as well. So it's becoming quite a rich resource. And really the reason we put it together isn't because there's a lack of training material out there, because when you look across the Virtual Academy, when you look across Channel 9, when you look at what's on there on Azure Docs, in terms of some of the tutorials, there's a whole host of stuff to go through. And in some ways, that's part of the problem is that there's almost too much to consume. Navigating your way around that can be quite difficult for partners who have a lot of competition for their time. So we put together the Citadel to really take through some of those partners to get them a real step change in their understanding of different areas. So the ARM templates is a good one. You can easily find information about how to spin up an ARM template. You can see some nice demos doing flashy stuff with ARM templates. But it doesn't necessarily get you to the depth of understanding about the topic area to mean that you're going to become ARM template ninjas after a couple of days of looking at those. And that's really where we're trying to take it to with this kind of training, where we're taking them through some step-by-step labs, which then build on each other and layer up until they get a real deep understanding of how they're going to use that as a service integrator or as an ISV to be able to do what they need to do for their customers.
Yeah, I mean, and it's not just – sorry, go ahead, Devin.
I was going to say that. I mean, that's awesome, Richard, because I know when I – you know, so I work with a lot of customers in my role, and, you know, I still find a ton of them – you know, they're going through the portal manually deploying stuff. I mean, I have found a decent number that are, you know, scripting things out, but, you know, I always try and push them to ARM templates, because at the end of the day, that's the way to kind of drive the DevOps model. And you have, you know, it's once you get it, it kind of makes life much, much, much easier, but they always struggle kind of ramping up on ARM.
Yeah. And that's part of what I see is that having run practices myself within partners, you want to define standards. You want to define standards so that you can then make that part of your reference architectures. You want to have that in your high-level design so that you can repeat as much of that proven capability for different customers. Yes, there'll always be slight tweaks to those, but you want to get as much repetition of that quality as possible. And ARM templates help you achieve that. So they help you to standardize that and fit into that to make sure you're consistently deploying stuff in a certain way. And it's the same for ISVs as well. When they're creating their applications, particularly those which are making their way onto the marketplace, then you want to make sure that those applications get deployed and the resources get spun up in a certain way. And it comes down to the way that we're working as well. So as we move into better ways of creating applications, so, you know, incorporating DevOps cycles and the whole continuous integration, continuous deployment pipelines, then infrastructure as code is a natural part of that. You need to be able to spin up those staging areas, you need to be able to deploy to those production areas. And again, ARM's got its place within the cycle. So it all comes together, and it's all part of the automation need that we see, where, frankly, I think the admins of tomorrow are very rarely going to go into a GUI and do anything, or go into a portal to do anything. It's all going to be CLI driven. It's all going to be template described. And you're going to do stuff at scale using those tools. And that's really how a lot of the ecosystem around Azure is constructed, so that once you get past some of that initial work, you start shifting onto working in those kind of ways. And that's when you start unleashing the real power of a platform like Azure.
Now, you mentioned system integrators and partners and whatnot, but I guess most large enterprises could benefit from ARM templates, right? It's not just limited to that set of customers.
No, absolutely. I think that there's a whole host of organizations where it makes a lot of sense. And certainly some of the larger enterprises that I've worked with, they've had their own enterprise architects who've defined which pillars they support and what standards they have within those. And anybody creating new applications within that organization had to essentially pick and choose from those which are going to be supported by the organization. And I think distilling that kind of structure into how you work means that you can still get the flexibility of doing things in sensible ways, but make sure that you're keeping a level of control and containing some of the excesses, if you like, of having a blank piece of paper, which is one of the most dangerous things to have in front of you when you start doing work on a cloud. I think having some patterns to follow is a good way of doing things. And I think that comes down to some of what I was told about when people start talking about the explosion of development within the cloud, is actually a lot of the standards forced through by, you know, AWS ourselves and other cloud providers actually helps standardize how you do stuff to a level where it actually encourages some of that innovation. So I think it's all good. I think there's definitely use for everybody.
Yeah, and I think it should be the exception that, you know, people that don't use templates should be a minority. I don't think there's any excuse not to use templates anymore. They seem quite easy, straightforward to get going. There's loads of great resources to build them and tools to help out. But having said that, I have seen some pretty large and unwieldy templates in my time as well, Richard. I don't know if you've come across the same. I've seen you look at somebody's template today and say, oh, that's a really nice template. I mean, what is it that they've done particularly differently to somebody else to make it, you know, something that's nice? Is it maintainability?
I think so. So there's you see a lot when you go onto the GitHub repo for the Azure Quick Start templates, you see a lot of the good practices for some of the better templates on there. And making good use of the sections within the templates is one of those things. So having a well-described parameters section where essentially you are stating which parameters are expected by the template, making good use of the variable section so that the resources section itself is then manageable. You don't really want to be having too much which is hard-coded or calculated further down there. So there's certain good things you can do to make sure it's as readable as possible. One of the things that I favor quite a lot is moving away from simple strings and integers for a lot of the parameter section, so that actually what you're feeding is more complex objects and arrays, which sounds like it's a bit counterintuitive, but actually once you see those, it's quite a dense set of information. And if it's constructed in the right way, then you can pass that through. So there's something you can do with ARM templates called nesting, where if you have something in a master template, you can describe that a certain way with some nice dense parameters, and then pass that through to those nested templates and hide away a lot of that, if you like, verbosity that you can get with some of the bigger templates, and actually make it a lot easier for a human to read and understand. Okay, it's only one of the criticisms. Go on.
I was going to say, when you're talking about that, just to be clear for some of the audience and even myself, are you talking about the fact that, like, you can say, I want, you know, four NICs versus describing each NIC independently? Or when you talk about nested and the arrays, how does that end up? What does that end up translating to?
So to give an example, rather than having one variable which describes your virtual network name, another one which describes your first subnet name, another one which then describes the address prefix for it, another one which then describes the second one, and having that, which is a fairly rigid structure and quite lengthy, once you see there's a lot of repetition there, mm-hmm. you can actually condense that down into a single object. So if you're familiar with JSON, where you've got the name value pairs and you've got simple array lists within that, you can combine those together and have what looks like a logical structure for that set of information, and just pass it through as your network information, and then have it pull out the different pieces when it actually gets down to the resources section. So one of the things that some people say about some of the other automation platforms like CloudFormation from AWS or Terraform, both of which use YAML, is that it's a bit more human readable. And I think this actually makes those inputs more human readable for the JSON-based ARM template.
So you're referring... That's great. I didn't know you could do that.
Right. So you're referring to a block of variables as one name, is that right? And one thing?
So passing through a single object and then having it basically roll through the arrays or pull out different sub-values within it. You guys use PowerShell and other things like that. It's very similar to the objects you're using there. We always pass through information as a block of information.
And when you talk about nesting, is that nesting within the same JSON file, or can you reference other template files from within one?
The answer to that is both, actually, and they've both got their uses. So when you deploy an ARM template, you deploy it into a resource group. So you're basically submitting it to that resource group to describe the resources you're trying to create. So the templates themselves describe the end result. They're declarative as opposed to a set of commands telling the system to do something, which is what we're imperative. And what you can, when you're doing that, then all the resources you're creating and describing within that template get submitted and deployed using the resource providers into that resource group, which is great. But there are occasions where you want to be able to manipulate in other resource groups as well. So a good example of that is VNet peering. So if we're connecting two VNets together for like a hub and spoke topology, then we can create a VNet in a resource group, but we can then peer that with the core VNet. And to do that peering, you need to basically connect it from both ends. So connect it from the spoke into the hub and from the hub into the spoke. So if the hub itself is in a different resource group, you can do that if you nest an inline template within your main JSON template. So that's one of the things we do. The other thing you can do is if you start designing building blocks, so let's take virtual machines as a good example, then we quite commonly invest quite a lot of effort into making sure our virtual machine templates are very effective, so we can specify how many managed disks we want for data, what different sizes of virtual machine we want, whether or not they're being backed up automatically or if they've got specific extensions. So customize that virtual machine to a standard which fits that particular enterprise or that service integrator's defaults. If we have nested templates, we can then reference that and call that from other templates and master templates and use that effectively. So if you've got something else which is automatically creating an availability set and it wants to have five virtual machines within that availability set, then that's quite easy to do and then call that nested template as a template URI, so uniform resource. And just call it that way. So that's a very common thing to do as well. And a good way, like I say, of hiding away some of the complexity of the templates, because then you're just basically calling the templates and passing in that block of dense information, which describes, I want this VM called this, and I want it this size, and I want it to have four disks. And then bosh, off it goes.
Cool. Okay. The other thing I've seen about, when we're talking about nice versus nasty ARM templates, I've seen quite a few where people have gone in and used the portal because there's an automation script button, I think, in most of the resource groups. You click on that and it kind of reverse engineers and generates a template for you with parameters and things like that. But they don't seem to always pick the right kind of parameters. Do you kind of recommend that people don't go down that route or start with other tools, or is there some trick to getting that to give nicer output?
Right, so there's two key points when you're using the portal when you can actually get it to create an ARM template for you. One is just before you create a resource. So if you click through and you've gone through one of your favorites or something in the marketplace and you start selecting all the parameters, and then just before you click create, there's a little blue link on the right-hand side of that, which I think is automation standards or something like that. And if you click on that, it'll then take you into a screen where it shows you a quite nicely constructed template, a separate parameters file, and it also gives you a few CLI scripts, so a PowerShell script, one for the Azure CLI, and a couple of the SDKs as well. So you can show how to actually get that submitted and deployed. So that's actually quite nice and quite useful. Quite often you'll want to refactor that, start shuffling things around between parameters and resources and variables just to make it your own. But it's a useful starting point for some of the services. The other one you're talking about is really when you're looking at an existing resource group, a resource group which has got some resources created within it, then there's a link on the left-hand side of the blade, again, for the automation side of things, which will create a template for you, which will recreate that resource group. And because it's basically there to enable you to redeploy that to other regions or wherever you want to use it for, is quite useful for that as a backup, as a snapshot of that configuration. Is quite useful. It'll do everything at the infrastructure level for that. However, it will be very long, it'll be very ugly, and it have a lot of hard-coded values within it. So it's nothing like the kind of templates we put together and the kind of templates you'll see on the Quick Start site. However, I will say it does have one use, which again, the labs go into this as well. If you look, there's some great reference information out there. So if you go to aka.ms/armref, A-R-M-R-E-F, then that'll take you to the reference pages for the different resource providers and types. So you can construct your own from within that. So it's a great resource in itself. What it isn't particularly good at is actually describing some of the values for a property. So it'll say something for any of the properties within it. It'll basically almost describe it by giving it its name again. So you don't know what kind of values will necessarily be accepted by it. So one of the things I quite like doing is use that export of the resource group as a snapshot. And then if I manually make the change that I want to see happen within that resource group, I can then re-export it and compare the two files. And then that shows you what has changed between the two, which is probably the parameter that you want. And then you can see what you've typed in via the portal and how that's ended up as a value within that template. So you can then start moving that into your freshly created template instead. So that's a good way of finding out that information.
Okay, that makes sense. And in terms of tools that you use to author templates, has you got a preference? Anything that sort of helps make life easier for anybody?
Well, there is a quick and dirty template creator actually within the portal itself. If you go and put template into the search, and then that'll take you through to there. You can use Visual Studio, you can use any third-party tools like Atom, Sublime Text, whatever else, but I have to say by far and away my favorite is Visual Studio Code. It might be because I come from the Linux side of life myself. Excuse me, that's the dog in the background. But it's very flexible. It's got some great extensions for Azure in general, for ARM templates generally. It supports snippets. It's got some great IntelliSense around highlighting any syntactical errors you might have in your templates. And you can also then start up the terminal session within it, so you can have your own PowerShell, Bash, or even Cloud Shell within VS Code to then actually test out the deployments. So everything's there baked into one very fast, very lightweight product for you to be doing stuff. And actually that's what we use within the lab. So the lab themselves are a bit of a love letter to Visual Studio Code, which is definitely my favorite Microsoft product of all time.
What are your recommendations for debugging some of these ARM templates? I remember doing it a while ago, and it was seemed to be a little bit difficult to figure out what's wrong with them.
So I think one of the problems is when you start, there's a whole host of functions as well. So again, throwing in another shortcut, aka.ms/armfunc, armfunc. That'll take you through to where the functions are. And once you start dealing with some of the more complex variables, some of the objects, some of the arrays, start using some of those functions, then it's very easy to start losing track of actually what you have. So one of the things I do with when we do hands-on workshops with some of the service integrators is we remove all the resources. It's absolutely valid in your template to have an empty array for your resources. So if you've got your parameters, you've got your variables, if you are doing clever stuff with that, with conditions and copies and all sorts of funky stuff within that, some of the functions we have, you can then use the output section to then output some of what you've then defined at that level. So you can run that through, and then, you know, 30 seconds later, once it's done the validation, run it through, then you'll find out actually what those variables look like. So it's a bit like tracing stuff through. Then if you know that all your variables have been created in the way that they should be created, if all your structures are looking correct, then adding the resources in one by one and slowly building up is something I've done before. So I did have one partner. He threw in a huge template very quickly with about 10 resources, and it didn't work. So we did exactly that. We basically took out the resources, made sure all his variables and everything else were coming out correctly, fixed a couple of those, and then slowly added the resources in one by one. And one of the reasons you can do that is the way that it describes the resources means that if you have, say, two resources already within the template and you've deployed it, when you then add in the third one, it'll basically see what's in that resource group and say, okay, resources A and B are already there, resource C needs doing, or resource D needs modifying, and it'll interpret that and make the right changes to that resource group. So again, it comes back to the whole idea of being declarative and describing how it works. So building stuff up that way is actually quite a quick and natural way of doing it.
So a quick question about that, because I want to make sure I understood it right. So you're saying when you break those pieces down and you validate them, you're talking about doing that in the offline tooling or only when you submit it?
So when you add it in, if you're using something like Visual Studio Code,
right,
then it'll basically highlight in red or give you warnings in yellow for anything which is syntactically wrong or doesn't match up with the API versions or something like that. So if you, if you've got something slightly wrong, it's going to help you out. And if you hover over those, it'll help you through and make some suggestions as to what will work. And silly things like making sure you've got the right number of braces and things like that.
Right, yeah, all that kind of stuff that would drive you crazy.
Yeah, it highlights either end of that section. So if you hover over one brace and it's highlighting a brace which is not the brace you should be pairing with, you know you've got something slightly out of skew and you can fix that. So it helps at that level. When you actually do the deployments, you can actually do, you know, taking the CLI as an example, an AZ group deployment validate, and they'll syntactically check it from the ARM side of things to make sure that ARM is happy that this is a good and working template. But there's still a whole host of stuff that only really gets done and evaluated, particularly things like copies and conditions and stuff like that, which you can only really do when you actually deploy it. So when you do that and run it, that's when you really test it. But like I say, taking out the resources and building up the resources, adding them one by one, is actually a good way of making sure, yeah, that resource works, that one works, that one works. Ah, that's the one that's caused me the problem. And then you can dig into to the difficult one.
Cool. Okay.
One last kind of observation that I've come across is people refer to ARM templates as infrastructure as code all the time. Just to highlight that it's not just the infrastructure as a service type resources that you can provision with ARM templates, is it? You can do the full gamut of PaaS services and so on. Is there any stuff that you've come across that you find that ARM templates can't do?
Yeah, so the best way to think about it is very good at doing the stuff which you normally do when you're creating services within the portal, and possibly a bit more than that besides as well. So if you treat it as, I think Terraform is actually a great name for the products from HashiCorp, because it's essentially what you're doing. You're setting out that landscape, you're putting everything in place. But it doesn't necessarily do all the data plane actions that you then want to do as well. And some of those you can do within the portal, but you can't manifest those within an ARM template. So to give an example, which is driving me absolutely crazy at the moment, Cosmos DB, which is, again, fantastic service, which I know you guys have talked about to death. You can create your Cosmos database. You can set which regions are going to be replicated, and you can set some of the defaults around that service, but you can't go and configure all the collections and everything else within it and all the different API versions and everything in one go. There's some stuff you have to do using some of the CLI commands, or via the portal or via the REST APIs or the SDKs, to make that happen. Over and above what you do within the ARM templates. But I know that's one of the areas where the product team that looks after ARM and ARM templates, they're constantly looking for where are those gaps, where are the areas that people want to start adding in additional functionalities that ARM templates and make them do more. And they're reaching more and more into that data plane for different services.
Yeah, actually, I noticed you can create storage accounts, but you can't necessarily then go and create the abstractions within it, can you, like in terms of the containers and folders within it?
You can't add in different container names and things like that. So yeah, there are some limitations as to what you can do at that level. Certainly on the infrastructure side, it seems to be pretty rich. When you talk about adding in different managed disks and NICs and public IP addresses and DNS and adding in virtual machine extensions and doing things like cloud in it or making use of Ansible, Chef Puppet to then reach into what the virtual machine is doing, it feels a bit richer from that point of view. To do that with some of the newer services, it's obviously one of those things they enhance and improve on as they work through the API versions, but you know the product teams are working within the same constructs, they're making stuff available within the CLIs, REST, and into the ARM templates, and so each of those services does get richer and richer over time.
Cool. Sorry, I think you've been asking all the questions. I think it must be a Brit-to-Brit translation thing that I'm doing here, but sorry, that you have some questions.
Brit-to-Brit translation, I love it.
I think this is really some very good tips and insights. Any questions for Richard from the team?
No, this is great, actually. It reinvigorates my, I try and use ARM templates when I can, but sometimes I get lazy and just drop to PowerShell, so this kind of reinvigorates my push to force myself to go use those and get better, because I think it is the right way to go.
Well, I'll be honest, my love of automation comes from a love of laziness as well. If I see something which needs doing more than once, then I'll work to make sure that I can be lazy in the future. So I think it's a good edict to live by.
Totally agreed.
Hi, Richard. I had a question around the parameters files for the ARM templates. So we're currently trying to provision multiple environments, and we have some sort of naming convention. Is there some quick way to generate all the parameters files as opposed to just them in one by one?
Well, there's
any recommendation around that?
So there's a couple of things, and this actually comes back into the conversation I have with different service integrators as to how they start putting different things together. So when I talked about the building blocks earlier and then having the master template sitting above that, one of the things we recommend doing is if you have a certain architectural pattern, a reference architecture, then having a master template which then constructs that and pulls in those rich building blocks makes a lot of sense. It then also makes a lot of sense to have a parameter file for different customers and having a lot of information in those parameter files. But one of the things you can do as well is you can use a mix of parameter files and then override or add to those parameters using inline parameters at submission time. So that gives you quite a lot of flexibility as to how you control that whole flow of information going through and leverage as many of those building blocks in different ways as you can. So that's one thing. The other thing is that if you're actually trying to construct parameters on the fly, which is something we commonly do when we're putting stuff in, is that certain languages tend to lend themselves to that quite nicely. And as you probably know, the Azure CLI itself is written in Python. Python's dictionaries, hashes, all very much match up with the same sort of objects and arrays that you have within it. So curly braces, square braces, it's very easy to create something within Python and output that as a set of JSON. And likewise, there's also some nice commands on the bash side of things if you're working in Ubuntu or another Linux distro. There's a nice little command line utility called JQ. So if you install that, then that enables you to manipulate and create JSON stuff using essentially James Path queries against stuff. So there are different ways of doing that to output those and then use those parameters.
Awesome, thank you.
Great, good question, Cynthia. So that's a good update from Richard. Thank you again very much for spending your afternoon or evening with us today. And we'll, if you have some of those links for Citadel, I know you've been talking about that a lot, send that my way and I'll put it in the show notes. Our listeners have that as an easy reference. Yeah. And any other stuff that you wish to share, of course, please send it our way.
So again, I've made life a little bit easier. There's a nice shortcut for Citadel. So if you go to aka.ms/Citadel, that'll take you there. And for the ARM template lab that a lot of what I talked about today is covered within those labs, then if you go to aka.ms/Citadel/ARM, that'll take you to that. But there's a whole host of other fantastic labs on that site that some of my colleagues have put together as well. So it's well worth browsing the whole site if you think there's something that's of interest.
It's really nice of you to put all those labs together. Thank you. I'm sure our listeners will appreciate that. All right. Well, that's a wrap then. And hope you guys in the UK, work through your weather and things get warmer.
Good luck digging out from that massive snowstorm.
All right.
Well, it's not stopped yet. It's still, I'm looking out the window now and it's quite deep, so I'm getting worried.
We might have enough to make a snowman soon.
Best of luck with that. Thanks for joining.
Thanks.
Thank you for listening to the show. If you have any comments or questions, please use our Twitter handle @AzurePodcasts. Background music has been taken from ccmixter.org under the Creative Commons license. Thank you, and see you next time.